Welcome to DevMode.fm, a podcast dedicated to the tools, techniques, and technologies used in modern web development. I'm Andrew Welch from NY Studio 107.
I'm Jennifer Blumberg from Next Solutions in New York.
I'm Matt Stein from Working Concept in Austin.
And I'm Patrick Harrington from Mildly Geeky in Boston.
Today, we have on Harry Robert, also known as CSS Wizardry. How you doing, Harry?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Good. So we wanted to have you on because we wanted to talk to you about web performance. So if you are out in the town of Buñol in Valencia, Spain, on the last Wednesday of August, and the La Tomatina Festival is in full swing, and you're crouched behind a wagon cart with tomatoes in hand, ready to strike, and a fellow tomato battler turns to you and says, hey, why should I care about web performance anyway? Like, what would you say?
Well, I throw tomatoes at him while he's distracted, so I'll just get those in.
Yeah.
My goodness, I mean, well, that's the weirdest question of 2020 so far.
Well, you gotta go quick. You gotta go quick or you're gonna get pelted in the face with a tomato.
Yeah. I'm like, so you know exactly what time you should be here for the tomato fight, because if the site was too slow, you would never found out, you'd have been late, you'd have missed it, and maybe something like that.
Ah, yeah, that's a good point. Good. Yeah. It's one of those things where I see it all the time, and I'm sure you see it all the time, Harry, because I know that you were kind of transitioning. So originally you were kind of doing a lot of stuff with CSS, right? Hence the CSS wizardry kind of moniker, right? And you were, fun fact, like you did this thing called ITCSS that was the basis for a lot of your work for a long time. And then it also is kind of the basis for Tailwind in terms of how they organize it. It's the framework that I use for CSS these days is Tailwind. But you're kind of transitioning to do more web performance stuff. So I did this for you. I did some research, okay? Webperf wizardry.com is available.
So, fun fact, the wizardry thing is probably one of the biggest professional regrets I have. I bought that domain when I was 17 years old. And the reason for that is I just finished reading CSS Mastery and I was like, ah, because I'm super original, I want something like that. But obviously, I can't have CSS Mastery. And there was a sale on .com domain names. So 17-year-old me went and got my mum's credit card, bought a domain for a couple of pounds. And then, 12 years later, here we are. Absolutely mortifying. And then I made the mistake of naming my company after it. So I was like, well, I might as well keep the company the same name as the website because that's kind of caught on. So now what will happen is I'll go visit like a client's office and they'll say, oh, which company are you with? And I have to just look them in the eyes and say, CSS Wizardry. And they just think I'm an idiot. So yeah, major regrets.
But I feel like with, you know, Harry Potter and that kind of thing, you know, it's kind of mainstream-ish, but you're locked into the CSS wizardry part of it, right, though? You know?
That's the problem. I don't have the budget or even the, like, a rebrand. The brand's not well-known enough to rebrand it. Also, I don't have the budget to do that anyway, because I don't even know how that would work. So, CSS Wizardry, the web performance person.
Well, anyway, I did check on four domains for you, in case you want. Webperfwizardry.com is available. Perfwizardry.com is available. Performancewizardry.com is available, although that might be confused with other kinds of performance. It might not be so great. And then speedwizardry.com is also available.
Also could Speed be confused. Wizard. Very confusing.
Anyway, so, but I do think it's really important to talk about web performance, and there are a bunch of different ways that we can approach it, right? So we can talk about like, okay, what are the things that we can do to make a site more performant? Like, what are the best things that we can do? But before we can even have that conversation, I think we need to convince people that it is important and we should do something about it. Like, how do you enter in that conversation with people when you're auditing their website and to convince them that spending a bunch of money to get the site performant is going to be in their best interest?
Yeah, this is honestly, it still to this day baffles me. People will email me asking me to make their website faster. And I'll reply saying, yeah, we can do that. And then they'll say, but why? And I'm like, what? You emailed me. Surely. Right. You know the answer, right? You emailed me. And towards the beginning of my sort of performance work, I would actually try and give them an answer. What I would do is I'd look at what industry they're in, whatever vertical they're in. I'd try and find a similar company and sort of say, hey, well, you know, Staples increased revenues by 1% by doing X, Y, and Z. And that's like a crude proxy, and that can sometimes get clients a little bit excited or at least interested. But nowadays, what I do is I'll just say to them, look, why have you emailed me? Like, you know, what do you think the benefit of this is going to be? And they'll have a vague notion of, oh, well, we know that, you know, in e-commerce, faster websites convert better or make more money. So they'll have a vague idea of what it is. And I'll just work with them to do the business analysis. So we'll run either multivariate tests or we'll capture some, you know, how much revenue do you make on days when you run X percent slower? Can we artificially slow the site down for a few percent of users and see what that does to conversions? Mm-hmm. So towards the beginning of a project, we will actually gather those metrics. And then we could, at the end of it, decide, oh, actually, your business, your product, your whatever is fairly immune to web performance issues. Therefore, we don't need to go any further. More often than not, that isn't the case, but it could be that, people are buying Ferraris, they're not going to be put off by a few seconds delay, right? So it depends on the product.
Right. I mean, if you are the only place to go for the thing, people are going to wait for it, right? It doesn't really matter.
Well, it's like, for example, the biggest example I can think of is I tend to fly with British Airways, and that site is absolutely appalling. Mm. But I've got to use it, right? I need to buy a British Airways flight. I need to use their site. So I've kind of just put up with it.
Yeah.
Which is why I think a lot of my work comes from e-com, purely because for most general kind of sites, there are lots of competitors and speed's a competitive advantage. So I work with a lot of retailers who, customers do have alternatives, and what they're trying to do is make sure those customers don't use those alternatives.
Yeah, and the bigger their volume, the more bang for the buck that they get, right? In terms of if you increase conversions by 1% for a business like Billy D. Joe Bob's Buffalo Tanning Hide business, where he sells just like one hide every week, it's not really going to make a difference. But if you make a change for a website that's doing $1 million a day, 1% is not nothing.
It's huge.
And it might be worth spending the money to do that. And you mentioned conversions, right? And I think that's a super important selling point, because that's the one thing that clients are just like, well, obviously, we care about conversions, right? We're in here to make money. The interesting thing is that, when I've been doing performance work, a lot of times I'm brought on via the marketing team. And the marketing team wants to increase conversions, but then the marketing team also wants to throw every tracking script under the sun on the website to then track it. Have you encountered that kind of tension?
All the time. And I don't know if I'm just getting a bit more jaded or miserable or just older. I used to really struggle trying to reconcile that stuff. Like, oh, I'm sure I can think of a way to make it work and we can have this and still be fast. Nowadays, I just get the client to put in writing or acknowledge in writing that if you want to put this on the site, it is going to make it slower. And it's my professional opinion that you just ought to. So can you just confirm that you're going to go ahead despite my advice? And they're like, yeah, okay, we'll do it. I did that recently with them. It was a publishing company. And they're like, oh, no, we need this thing to get the some tracking data. And I was like, right, but it's tangible. It's making the site about half as slow. It's really, really bad. So yeah, but we need it to track the customers. It's like, well, look, can you please, in writing, just reply to this email saying that you're going to stick with it and that, that is going to be this basically the end of the road. And they're like, yep, I'm afraid it is. So it's fine. They paid up and it's all good. But
right,
it's one of those things where we're developers, right? We're not miracle workers. People on Hacker News probably fancy themselves a bit more like miracle workers.
That's the tough thing, though. I've done that too, where I've gone in and I've gotten site super performant, and then I come back in 3 months and, they're just tracking script after tracking script has been added to it and the performance is terrible. And it's this weird tension. Because they want to track the customer, but if the site performance becomes terrible because of the tracking, then you're going to have fewer customers.
It's like Heisenberg-y observer effect-y thing. It's like
exactly
you're measuring you're sending them away. Like, and I've got a bit of rhetoric, which is a bit, I don't know, it's not tongue in cheek, but it's a bit, I don't know what the word is, but basically what I will say to my clients is, let's say, for example, this client sells, I'm sat in my kitchen, right? So kitchen knives, they sell nice kitchen knives and they want to add some tracking, right? And they're really keen, like, no, we need to track where people go. We need to retarget them. We need to do this. And I'll just say to them, look, is your primary business, is it selling knives or is it gathering data? And they're like, selling knives. And I'll say, right, well, don't do any single thing that gets in the way of selling those knives.
Right.
Slowing the site down, doing X, Y, and Z, having annoying interstitials to sign up to a newsletter, that's not going to sell a knife. That's going to annoy someone. Do all that secondary. Like, if you need retargeting stuff, lazy load it. You need reviews, whatever, lazy load them. Just don't get anything, don't put anything in the way of whatever your primary business model is. And then usually they kind of, that just gets them around to thinking, oh yeah, I guess we just want to sell our knives, really.
Yeah. I mean, that's our goal, right? In the end. And I've run into kind of amusing situations where companies will, or marketers, they'll want to put like every single tracking thing that they can throw at it. They're going to put in there, full story, hot jar. This is going to like throw everything on there. And I've seen companies do that and, huge overlap between a lot of these tools that they're putting on there. But then also they don't end up doing anything with the data. you know, or they don't have a plan. Like they just, they know they want to track, but then, okay, we're tracking. What do we do now? Like, what do we, how is this useful?
And because they don't know what they're actually measuring, companies tend to defensively track everything. Like, we'll turn all the options on. Because then if we've got the data, we can work it out afterwards. And they never do.
Right.
I've had loads of things. I've got, if you'll indulge me, I've got three separate little anecdotes about this exact thing.
I want all three.
First one.
Let's do it.
First one. And by far my favorite was, I was doing an audit for a client, 2 years ago now. There's this third party, like analytics-y, capture-y kind of thing, like not quite a tracking thing, but whatever, sort of. And I just said to them, hey, look, there's a bunch of stuff on the site I've got questions about, but this one in particular, how much do we use this? You know, and one guy in marketing was like, oh, vital, like talk about other things, but that one needs to stay. And I was like, oh, okay, right. It's just how much value do you get out of it? Is it worth what the perceived, you know? And he was like, no, just that one. We definitely need that one. We love it. And the reason I was asking him was because it was an async snippet that had been copied and pasted from some docs kind of thing into the head. But it hadn't been pasted from docs. It had been pasted out of an email in Outlook, and the straight like HTML quotes had been changed for curly quotes.
Oh no.
And it'd been pasted into the head. It's basically one great big syntax error. Uh-huh. And I did a git log of the entire file, the whole history of the file. This snippet had never, ever been correct, which means that this tool had never, ever, ever worked.
But it's vital. Like, but it's vital, Harry.
Like the Emperor's New Clothes, right? The marketing guy was like, he'd got the budget for it. He'd got the budget approved.
Yeah.
And he'd convinced everyone, yeah, we're going to spend this much a year. And it had never worked, but he was too nervous to then say, it's not working. So he just was like, no, don't touch it. And I didn't call him out publicly at all, but I was like, hey, look, it's never worked. Let's get rid of this and we'll spin it. So you can tell your manager now that you've managed to save them X amount a year.
Right.
We'll spin it in a positive. But there's that one.
Yeah, that's really good the way you turned that around too. You made it so, you know, instead of him being humiliated and out of a job, you know, you managed to turn it into something where, hey, you know, look, on the down low, look at it, where you can just say we're saving a bunch of money and, you know.
Yeah, we've decommissioned this tool.
We found it was ineffective, you know, whatever. Yeah, that's great.
That's funny. And then another time, this is a nicer story. Like, no one got anything wrong with this one. But a client I worked with really recently had Optimizely on the site, and it had quite a big overhead. And Optimizely is about $108,000 a year.
Yep.
And they just weren't using it enough. They were like, well, we got a license for it, but we honestly don't do that many tests and blah, blah, blah. And what we ended up doing is, well, if you don't run many tests, and they were using the client-side Optimizely tool.
No.
So if you don't run many tests, the worst one, right? I was like, well, if you run tests that infrequently, can we not just use the feature inside of SpeedCurve to do them on the server side and do them that way? So what ended up happening is they bought SpeedCurve at like $18,000 a year, and that allowed them to immediately decommission Optimizely, saving them $108,000 a year, by just using different tools. One thing I find fascinating about SpeedCurve, most people who end up on the SpeedCurve site are developers, and developers don't normally tend to have budget, right? They have to go to their manager for that. And what will happen is a developer will be like, $18,000 a year for SpeedCurve, I can't. There's no way I'm going to ask my manager for that. Whereas what they don't realize is their manager is spending $150,000 a year on Analytics 360. Like, SpeedCurve is a bargain, but a lot of developers don't realize just how cheap it is. So that was a great story. Managed to decommission Optimizely in favor of doing it on the server with SpeedCurve.
That's crazy. And they were paying them $180,000 a year for this thing.
And
they
were doing, but yeah.
What? Okay. Yeah. $108,000. And they were doing it client side. So they're having the worst of both worlds in terms of like the performance of it and the payment of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Basically, it was just a very expensive way to achieve very little. Because the thing as well, they weren't running many tests at all, maybe three a year, but the Optimizely script was still live on the site, just
Harry,
always
you're,
evaluating.
You're triggering me, like literally, like everything you're saying is just triggering me, because this is another pet peeve of mine is A/B tests. Like, so many companies I've been called in to work with, like, we want to do an A/B test. But you don't have a reasonable hypothesis, there's no point in doing an A/B test, right? You don't just like change a headline and then A/B test it. You can't punt off your responsibility for writing good copy or doing good design or whatever and say, well, let's let an A/B test sort it out. And then also, pursuant to what you're talking about, if they're doing it client side, if you're impacting the performance of the page when you're doing the test, how do you know what you're measuring? You know?
Right, exactly. You've got this huge, huge observer effect there. And it is the worst. The one benefit of client-side A/B testing is that you can test without a deploy, right? So it means that you don't have to bother your engineering team. For companies that run a lot of tests, that is beneficial. The problem if you're running a lot of tests is, well, what is your cross section? If you're running that many tests, how do you know which infinite variation of those tests is the one that's working? Actually, okay, here's a real horror story. You think that was bad? Story 2.5. I worked with a big client. Everyone's heard of them. They were using, none of them enjoyed using the CMS. The CMS was just clunky. So they basically made page level content changes using Optimizely.
Oh no.
So basically they'd send the logging to the CMS to update the masthead image or to update some copy. They would just go in the Optimizely UI and be like, all right, this button needs to say $39 instead of $59 or whatever, or this image needs to be this. So what would happen is the page would download the original image.
No.
Then the A-B test would run, then it would go download the second one, while the whole time opacity zero important on the body. The page is about 4 seconds slower than it needs to be.
My
initial advice, because I didn't realize the extent of what they were doing. So I was like, well, if you async load your Optimizely, you're going to get 4 seconds back. And they're like, yeah, but if we do that, customers are going to see two pages. And I was like, what do you mean? If you look at our Optimizely config, and I was like, ah, shit, what have you done?
My God, Harry, you got me in full double face palm. My hands are sweaty. Like this is driving me crazy. It's great that they have autonomy, right? That they're able, the marketing team is able to go in there and just make changes. But if the results of the tests are going to be largely ineffective because you don't know what you're measuring, whether it's the performance or the jank or whatever, like who cares that you can do it yourself? You know, I mean, I don't.
Yeah, right. All for nothing in the end, right?
Yeah, I mean, and your story about saving the money reminds me of a company I was called in to do some consulting work on. And they had this hosting that was with a company that I'm not going to name the company, but it sounds like Smackface. And this was a pretty much a simple marketing brochure site. Guess how much they were paying per month for hosting this thing?
I don't want to guess.
So it was
more than $20.
Was it like five figures?
Five figures?
Over 10,000?
Over 10,000. Jen, you got a guess on this, what they were paying for the brochure site hosting?
A brochure site?
Yeah.
So it wasn't $15 a month? Are you saying it was more?
I'm not saying anything. I'm just, what do you think it might have been?
I'm going to guess three figures, upper three figures.
Upper three. Okay. So under 1,000. So Patrick, how about you?
Well, I just this week talked to a client who is currently paying $1,800 a month for their brochure site hosting. So I'm going to go $2,000.
$2,000? Matthew, you got any? I know you're the king of like auditing all of these, inexpensive VPSs to figure out which is the best. What do you think that people?
That's right. It's going to be more than $50. I know that already, but okay. I'll guess $10,000.
All right, so you're up there with Harry. Well, it ended up being about $35,000 a month. Like, not even kidding. Not even kidding.
I could get them a great deal. Like, I could get them down to 30 easily.
I transitioned them to a Vulture VPS, and they're paying $40 a month. And it's serving all of their traffic, and everything is wonderful. And
they have new five full-time employees that they can now pay. Jeez.
Isn't that great? I mean, it's just...
Negligence? Like, did they get their money back from the people who initially did this? I mean, that's
That's
the important question.
It's insane, right? But here's the thing. This is a company that they didn't really have a tech team or whatever. So someone who didn't really know a whole lot was sold by someone who said, hey, use Rackspace, this thing. And they didn't really know what they're getting. You know what I mean? Like they probably had no idea what they needed or whatever. And the ironic thing is, I was called in as a consultant and here I saved the company a ridiculous amount of money by converting this thing over to this $40 a month thing. I saved them like, over $250,000 a year. And the leadership had no idea who I was. And they actually questioned like some of the billing expenses when they were submitted. Like, I saved them over $250,000 and they were complaining about a couple of $1,000s in billing.
Like, somewhere in that story, in the movie version of that story, there's a scene with no audio where somebody makes a face when they've realized how that's the part I want to cut to now.
Oh my goodness.
It's also that's like the whole value-based pricing thing. Like that's
I don't have to word it without sounding patronizing, but I'm self-employed, right? And I do consultancy work.
Sure.
So I'm very aware of my work has to equate to some kind of either financial improvement or some kind of savings.
Right.
But that's just me being a developer, right? And every developer wields that power. And I think a lot of people I work with who are like full-time employees just don't realize that their own technical decisions could have that amount of impact in a business. And then that gives them leverage for promotions, pay rises, whatever. It's really, really impressive. Like just the amount of things that individuals can just spot and just by knowing the right thing to do, it's huge.
Not if they don't know who you are, though. Go ahead, Matt.
Well, that's the only problem. I had a fascinating thing. 2018, I think, I was working for... I'm not going to name the company. I can't really say much about them other than they're based in Tallinn, Estonia, and they deal in Bitcoin, right? So it sounds dodgy as hell, but they're an amazing company, really great. And a lot of their customers were coming from Southeast Asia, so basically they wanted me to focus on sort of mobile in Southeast Asia. So I dug into their analytics. And one thing I found really interesting was, yeah, sure enough, like Singapore, South Korea, Vietnam, et cetera, was pretty slow, but there was a massive, just big dark cloud hanging over Venezuela. I was like, what's going on here? There's something wrong with, like, Venezuela is weirdly slow, but Colombia isn't, right? Brazil isn't. Argentina isn't. Why Venezuela? Why is it so much worse than everywhere else? So I did some digging and I learned three really interesting things, right? Well, the first one I already knew, Venezuela's economy is tanked. So they want to get their hands on any not Venezuelan currency.
Right.
Now, by default, that's going to be US dollars, but Bitcoin counts. So that's first thing is they try to get their hands on any not Venezuelan currency. Part of that would be Bitcoin. Second thing is, in a bid to try and recover the economy, Venezuelan government actually released their own cryptocurrency, right? Terrible idea.
Yeah, right. I remember that.
They minted something called Petra. Mm-hmm. So now all of a sudden you've got an entire country that is at least predisposed to the idea of cryptocurrency. The third and most fascinating part of the puzzle was electricity is free in Venezuela, right? It's all subsidized by the government. No wonder their economy's tanked. So if someone leaves their machine on overnight, wake up, they made 3 cents. So they're literally printing money. So there's a small, like, the small part of this country is just wise to it. And like, well, we can just print money, make Bitcoin, and go and spend it with this Estonian website, right? Go spend it there, this free money. So even though my client had said, look, can you focus on Southeast Asia? I was like, look, I'll take a look at that. But I had a meeting with the CEO and I said to him, look, do you know about your Venezuela problem? And I on purpose worded it a bit aloof. And he was like, I don't know what that means. So I sat him down and I explained the whole extent of the Venezuela thing. So the whole project kind of changed a bit to focus on Latin America, specifically Venezuela. So I set up I got some data about how the web feels in Venezuela, went around all the engineers' machines in the office in Tallinn and made their machines run like they had a Venezuelan connection. And I basically annoyed them into improving the site. This company ended up making so much money from Venezuela that they had to hire a full-time member of staff just to count all the pennies. It was ridiculous. And that's just because, you know, one nerd from England looked in the right panel in Google Analytics, right?
That's incredible.
That client loves me. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's incredible. And it's nice when you're doing your job, whatever your job is, it's nice to feel you're making an impact, right? It's nice to feel that you're doing something good and you're making a difference. And I like the way that you're pulling some of this performance stuff into real world examples, because I've done similar things where you mentioned earlier that you would try putting the website and artificially slowing it for a while, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of the clients that we end up working with, they're sitting at a computer on a high speed internet connection in a, you know, first world or whatever term you want to use country, you know, with modern infrastructure. So they're essentially viewing their website in the absolute best case scenario that anyone will ever see it, you know? And it's really important that you make people understand that this is the absolute best case. So I've even done it where I've gone in and for a day I've artificially limited, you know, in league with their IT department, artificially limited their internet connection speed to what it would be if they were surfing it on, you know, 3G or 4G, right? Mm-hmm. Amazing how many allies you can get on board when you show them, hey, you know, you're not experiencing reality. Here's reality, you know?
Yeah. Another interesting aspect I see real similar to this is everyone believes that everything's an edge case. But when you add all the edge cases together, it's like, oh, right, yeah, it's very rare to have that normal plain sailing experience. So in internal talks, one of the exercises I've done a few times with with companies is I'll just say something like, right, just stand up and remain standing if you've ever had a 4G icon on your phone, but your data isn't actually working. And loads of people stand up. You stay standing. Anyone else, if you've ever used crappy hotel Wi-Fi, please stand up and stay standing. And that's just... It only takes 3 or 4 questions until 95% of the room standing up. And I'll say, right, look around. You're all what you would consider to be an edge case, right? Everyone in this room is an edge case, right? It's not as rare as you think. And that often gets people thinking, oh, yeah, you know, he's right. Like, this stuff that happens to me happens to my pal down the street. It happens to my neighbor. It happens to everyone. And that's a good way of getting people, or it can be a good way of getting people on board. It's a bit wishy-washy, but it's effective.
You strike me as at least 19. In the time that you've been performance wizarding, how have people's like appreciation or perceptions of performance changed? Or has it?
It's getting, I don't want to say in vogue, because I'm hoping it's not just a passing trend, but it's certainly way more of a thing now. I think we had a bit of a spot, because we had like, I don't know, I didn't really use the web in the 90s ever, but I'm aware of like, you know, things were way slow back then. So we would actually have performance budgets before they were even a thing. Then we had that kind of middle bit where the iPhone hadn't been invented yet, mobile browsing wasn't really a thing, and everyone just thought, oh, well, you know, everyone's basically got the exact same setup at home. And then as soon as mobile took off and the diversity sort of just ballooned,
right,
it became back in fashion. And then I think now with the next billion users and a big focus on emerging economies, we're seeing that, yeah, the Western web is not exactly how the rest of the world is going to experience it. But it's definitely people getting way, way, way more interested in it, which is great for me because I'm selling it.
Have you also seen, because, I mean, for example, I like to read the news on my phone. I have a pretty old phone and I find it to be incredibly frustrating with the proliferation of advertising that's on, I mean, news sites especially, but other websites. And you mentioned you've been working a lot with e-commerce companies, but I was also wondering if you could talk about news sites and things like that that are making at least the mobile experience horrible. Like I can only read on my computer with ad blocker. Otherwise I just get angry and, you know, start throwing things.
Yeah. News sites are notorious. They're the worst. They're like infested with STDs. I mean, they're just horrible.
That's so bad.
Yeah.
I've actually been working with a publisher in North America, a news site. I've got a bunch of their tabs open right now, but I won't name and shame them. Basically, the problem goes way further back, right? The web was basically built on fanciful ideals. So you've got all these newspapers who've gone from selling a physical newspaper every morning to be like, oh, just stick it on the internet for free.
Right.
And panicking that, oh shit, we're not making any money.
Right.
And defensively, the only thing they could think to do is, like, the paywall thing is way too late because people are used to it being free.
Yep.
So it's just ads. It's infested. And so the problem obviously goes way, way further back than just ads. It's just the whole business model is wrong.
Yep.
So one thing I'd done with this publisher in the US, or this North American publisher, is we just looked at, okay, how far can you push it? Like, there's a sweet spot. The more ads you put on a page, the more money you're going to make. But at a certain point, there's going to be too many ads and people get annoyed enough they're going to disappear. What's that sweet spot? What is the most we can get away with? And working that out has been fascinating. Again, lots of multivariate test kind of things. And working out that, okay, this is the sweet spot of abandonment versus revenue. You're not going to keep everyone happy, but it's like kind of your sweet spot for revenue. It's actually going to mean removing some ads to get the engagement up so you get more eyeballs on pages. And it's just, you've got to follow the numbers, really. But ideally, I just wish we could, you know, time machine and go back and fix the actual business model itself, because I hate consuming news on the web. I still buy newspapers, right? Well, maybe once a month, but consuming news on the web is awful.
I agree with you, man. And I agree that the problem is business model oriented, because there's ads, which is one thing, but then there's also all of the infrastructure that you bring along with you once you decide to put an ad on a page, which is that the company that is placing the syndicate that is handling that ad, as well as the person placing that ad, wants to know how well is that ad performing. That's where all of this tracking stuff comes in. And, you know, different ad networks will use different stuff. And you end up with this, like the company, let's say it's a newspaper, it's an online newspaper. They're not going to turn down an ad just because it's coming from a different network. You know, they need the money. A lot of these companies are really, you know, their heyday is gone and they're really hurting for cash. So they'll take ads from anywhere. So you'll have multiple ad networks with multiple methods of tracking, and you just end up with this junk everywhere, you know. And, you know, there are a number of tools that you can use to audit sites like this. But there's a really nice tool that I use, like Web Page Test, for instance, can do it, right? You'll see all of this stuff that is spiraling down there. But there's also a request map site, which I think uses I think it uses Web Page Test under the hood, but it visually shows like where everything kind of spreads and what fires what. And it's just amazing when you run that on like a CNN.com or something, like it's incredible.
Horrifying. I've been dealing with, I'm really good friends with Simon, who built that, and he's been putting in some feature requests for me, because one thing I want to see that tool do is isolate just Because you've got third parties and you've got the third parties and their third, well, fourth, fifth, sixth parties.
Mm-hmm.
We got no control over those, right? So I don't really want, I don't really care about fourth, fifth, sixth parties. I want to isolate that first ring of who are we actually linking out to.
Right.
That's as if we can control. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there should be some nice stuff coming up in request map soon.
Yeah, but that's a great tool. And just the nice thing about that tool is it's visceral. You look at it, you show it to someone that maybe they don't even know what it means, but they can be like, whoa. You know, like,
they can see if there's a lot of data on it, right? Yeah. You could tell them it's anything.
Right.
And you're like, oh, looks, this, that doesn't look healthy.
Yeah. Like you can say,
one really nice thing.
Yeah, you can say, imagine this is crawling on your skin. How would you feel about it? You know?
Yeah. One, so I had like another little, a nice story about marketing and tracking and stuff.
Okay. They exist. Little, okay. I'm impressed. Let's
yeah. Well, this was really, I don't want to say heartwarming, but like this is a nice little tale of working with a client who, I was actually brought in to do design systems work, but I was like, yeah, also your site is terribly slow. So can we take a little look at that?
Sure.
And they were like, oh yeah, it's not really us. It's more like the marketing team and the marketing, like this company is based in the UK and it was the UK arm of a US firm. And they're like, oh, but the head of marketing, she's in the US and she's a bit like, you know, they're all a bit scared of her. And I was like, well, you know what? It's my job to have these awkward discussions. Let's take a look.
Sure.
So I looked through the site and I was like, oh geez, yeah, this third party stuff's got way out of hand. So using request map, I exported the raw data, pulled it into a spreadsheet, which then just highlighted any duplicates. So using two ad providers, right? We've got three analytics accounts, whatever. Mm. It would highlight any duplicate categories. And it would also, just on a scale of from white to really dark red, on a gradient scale, it would color in each cell for like how bad it is. So anything that had just one request would be basically white. But anything, any domain that had 200 requests would be really deep, like blood red. And you could just visualize at a glance, like the, right, the shape of things.
Yeah.
And they were like, oh yeah, like it's good to have the data for marketing. They just, oh, we're scared of them. I just got on a call with the marketing team and the woman was like, oh my goodness, this is gold. We were aware of the problem. We knew it's like marketing debt, I guess, rather than tech debt. She was like, we just had no idea where to start. And it's been on this, one of these things, we're trying to avoid the discussion because we had no idea what to do. And I was like, well, look, automated it, done it for you. Let's work through it. And they were, the team in the UK was like, just sigh of relief. They thought they were going to get shot at for this.
Right.
It turns out the marketing team were just so grateful because they knew they had a problem. And it wasn't like they were precious about it. They were really grateful for the work that we'd done. And that was a really heartwarming thing. Just talk to people.
Yeah, that's impressive because it's impressive that they knew there was a problem. Because I've seen it also where I worked with one company that they had Adobe Tag Manager, I think is what they were using. And a lot of people had come and went from the position of, you know, the person who handled this stuff.
Right. No,
nobody knew what everything did. You know, there was just stuff in there, right? And
that is such a common thing, isn't it?
Yeah. And then instead of, they wanted to transition to use Google Tag Manager but they couldn't figure out like what was needed and what wasn't. So we kind of came up with a system where before any tag could be created, someone had to own it. Right. A person's name, like X person owns this tag and here's the reason why it exists. And so anytime anything was added, it was documented. Right. So they at least had some way they could come back and be like, you know, we don't need this anymore. We can audit this out or we can get rid of that. Cause for a while, they were running both Google Tag Manager and Adobe Tag Manager on the same site. And there was just stuff everywhere, you know?
That's a really nice approach, much more responsible than my approach, which is normally just turn it off for a week. And if no one emails you complaining, then it can probably go.
But that gets back to what we're talking about before. You know, this guy that you were talking, guy, girl, whoever it was that had that snippet of code that was absolutely critical, right? That you mentioned that never worked.
Vital.
You know what I mean? Absolutely vital. Never worked. So then, and also our discussion about, well, is anyone actually doing anything with this data, right? You know, like if you're putting all these tags out there and you're having this impact on what you're trying to do, you're trying to convert customers, you're tracking them, you're doing remarketing, you're doing whatever you can to get those sales, at least have a plan to make sure that you're utilizing this data and it's not just wasted.
I think a huge problem a lot of businesses have is they don't have business analysts. They don't have people who have the in and out of this live session tracking tool costs this much,
right,
and we perceive that's going to save us or make us this much a year. So if you can put numbers against it, no one really wants the fast website. They want the most profitable site. So I don't care if you can prove to me that your real-time session tracking tool is going to make you more money than the slowdown it will cost you, if that makes sense, and keep it.
Right.
Like if you know, making this like 500 milliseconds slower by having this tracking tool is going to make you more money than having a 500 milliseconds faster website, then yeah, I'll pipe down. I'll keep my mouth shut. Like it's not,
yeah.
No one really wants the fastest website, but no one can ever prove that to me. So it just means that it puts me in a fairly good position because it's like, well, look, if there's no business case for this, then that's performance aside, right? That's a good enough reason to bin it because you've not costed it. You've not worked out what it's bringing you back. So that like helps me out a lot with making my case, but a lot of people just aren't aware of it.
Well, and I love the fact that in this example that you gave earlier, that the marketing team was like, oh, thank you. Like we needed somewhere to start because, you know, this shouldn't be that we're just kind of blaming marketers for creating these tags because marketers are, they're supposed to be good at marketing, right? They're not supposed to be good at managing website performance and knowing the technical implications of what they're doing. I've run into similar things where people are grateful that I am letting them know that there is a cost associated with what they're doing because they're like, oh, well, we don't want that because that's going to slow down our site, which is then potentially going to hurt conversions way more than we would benefit from, you know, tracking these people down to the, you know, the type of beer they like to drink when they're sneaking right, into a pub underage, you know? I mean, how much is that data worth to you, you know?
Well, this is, I'm going to name this company because they were absolute angels. One of the nicest companies I've ever worked with. Late last year, I worked with Vitamix out in Cleveland, Ohio, working on their e-com site. And they were one of the most receptive, enthused, engaged companies like in general, not just the engineering team, but everyone who got involved fully. And one thing I always insist is that at the end of the project, the dev team, the engineering team does a demo to the entire company. Hmm. Just to show that you know, we haven't just been sat in a room doing nothing for a week. Here's what it does. Here's what we did. And here's how it impacts the business. And I invite everyone. It's like, I want marketing there. I want finance. I want customer support. I want everybody in this room. And we do the demo and it's good and it's good fun and see what the fruits of our labor have been. But the Vitamix marketing team were there and we were saying things like, yeah, you know, we actually are already pretty responsible, but we do need to be aware of every time we add a Pinterest retargeting thing, that's going to have a cost. And the marketing team were just like, holy shit, this is fascinating. We didn't really know any of this. So afterwards, they came separately sort of like to ask questions like, what can we do to help? How can we, should we run things by you before we add them? Should we do this? And it's just one of the most amazing, just watching how enthused they were and how like enlightened. And the engineering team were like over the moon about it as well. And it's one of those things where one of the weirdest parts of my job is non-technical. It's just making sure people chat to each other. So we ended up getting some custom monitoring up in SpeedCurve. So it'd be things like, does adding a new sharing widget impact the amount of signups we get, yes or no? Because you can capture everything with SpeedCurve. Did adding the Pinterest button slow down our start render at all? And did that have a knock-on effect on conversions or session length or whatever? And yeah, that was a good project.
So Harry, are you worried at all about SpeedCurve just kind of putting you out of a job? I mean, can I just go in, set up SpeedCurve and away we go?
No, really. Like it'll tell you what's slow, but it won't tell you how to make it fast. You still need someone to actually implement it or guide you. I've got a really, really great working relationship with the SpeedCurve team. So it's fairly symbiotic. I use SpeedCurve for my own stuff. So I started to learn it. Well, I just know it very, very well and got almost like a good line into support with them. So normally what happens is the problem gets inverted. I'll work with clients and I'll be like, look, you need to get SpeedCurve on the site and I'll show you how to set it up. So weirdly, the opposite's kind of true. It's often a good line into businesses for me.
Yeah. I mean, that makes sense because there are lots of tools like that. You know, like for instance, I've got this crazy DAC that I use for mixing the podcast together and I open up the UI for it and I have no idea what I'm doing. Like it's just got knobs and levers anywhere, right? So just giving this to me doesn't make me an audio engineer. You know what I mean? Just in the same way, like, you know, just giving someone SpeedCurve doesn't necessarily, you know, make them really good at diagnosing and then implementing, as you said, the performance stuff.
Yeah. And the other thing as well is, a lot of companies don't want to be that involved with it, right? They like the idea that, so a company I'm working with at the moment, they're like, hey, can you just set SpeedCurve up for us? Can you just show us what to do? But yeah, I mean, that's billable work. I'll happily do it. And what they're going to end up is like a wealth of data and a wealth of metrics that, yeah, their engineers are going to fix, but I'll sort of guide that. So a lot of people, yeah, they'll have the tools, but they will usually want someone else to actually become the domain expert in it, which again is great for me because I adore using SpeedCurve and I get to learn it inside out because you'll have specific examples or specific scenarios that you've got to solve. One thing that I do worry about in terms of not job security, but, you know, becoming obsolete is a lot of web performances just work around, you know, trying to work with an antiquated stack, right?
Yeah.
You know, H1, et cetera, is being obsoleted by H2, which is going to be obsoleted by Quick. or H3. So that's the kind of stuff where I think, oh, goodness, like once we've fixed it at the actual root, kind of the core of the problem, that's when performance engineers are going to start being, or should be a little more scared.
You know, the fun thing about Quick is that, so the protocol that we use for the web right now with HTTP is TCP, right? So that's like the network level protocol that's being used. And back in the day when I was working on internet games, back before anyone had, you know, low latency broadband, one of the things we were trying to implement was a reasonable system that would work. And you just can't do it with TCP. Right. Because
it's slow by default.
It's too slow because it has this whole layer of, you know, acknowledging stuff and verifying and all that kind of stuff. So you end up using UDP, which is a lower level protocol. The fun thing about UDP is you send this packet out, but then there's no guarantee that it gets there. There's no reply back. Right. There's nothing that says this made it through. Like it's just sending a raw packet out there and who knows how many of them are going to make it. And Quick is a layer based on UDP that adds a little bit of the insurance that you would need for or that TCP has for things that you know you have to get the actual data back, but apparently without some of the overhead of TCP. So it's going to be interesting. Yeah, yeah. It was interesting when I was reading up on Quick and what it actually was. I'm like, oh, I remember doing stuff with that, like, you know, 15 years ago.
It's all Disney again. Yeah, just taking the speed benefits of UDP and putting a thin film of TCP-like behavior over the top of it. And there's things like, TLS 1.3 gets you down to a theoretical zero round trip to establish a secure connection. You've gone from three round trips down to potentially zero on like a warmed up connection.
Yeah.
Or like a cached. It's just stuff like that. You just think, oh, goodness. Right. I'm going to have to really find some stuff. Although then saying that, I've still got clients who turn up with 6 meg PNG images on my homepage. So it's like, there's still some low-hanging fruit.
But you're right, though. I mean, a lot of it is optimizing for old stacks and old ideas and old ways of doing things, right? You know, so one of the biggest gains on any site is usually fixing the images so that the images are optimized and we're not serving like this massive image down to a tiny little mobile device, you know?
Yeah.
And all of this stuff is important to conversions and page load and all that kind of stuff. But there are some other things, right? So there's also energy conservation, right? I mean, apparently they did a study and in the US alone in 2017, we use 90 billion kilowatt hours of electricity for data centers. Just for data centers, right? And, you know, things are getting more, you know, we're not building less of them, right? We're building more and more of this stuff. And
absolutely.
And that gets back to, you know, news of the day, stuff burning down in Australia and, you know, protecting the environment and all that kind of stuff. And these all kind of tie together. And it reminds me of, you know, one of the things my wife does is when we go to restaurants, she will not allow them to bring straws. So she has metal straws that she just brings with us and we just wash them. And you might be like, oh, you know, big deal. Like, you know, it's not really going to make a big difference anyway or whatever. But I don't think you should ever kind of crap on someone for making a small difference, even if you think it doesn't matter. And as web developers, this is one area that we can make a difference. You know, it is our choice when we sit down to build these things. It is our choice whether we make them performant or not, or whether we're super wasteful with our resources or not. You know,
so this is really quite fascinating to me. I've got a really good friend called Asim Hussain, who he works at Microsoft, but he's doing a lot of speaking at the moment about sort of the environmental impact of tech and web development. And I think the problem is it's hard to quantify. And as web developers in general, we're abstracted away from so many things. Like people literally forget that all the mobile phones in the world that view like our websites are left charging up overnight every night, right? That,
yeah.
There's power behind everything.
Right.
The MacBook you're using. Mine's plugged in right now, taking energy out of the wall, right? But we just forget the most basic, simple, fundamental things that if you've got the fans start spinning, you see your laptop battery dying because Chrome's up to 2 gig of memory usage again. Like you're going to have to plug your laptop in an hour sooner than you expected. That energy's coming from somewhere.
Yeah.
So it's stuff like that. It's fascinating. It's really obvious when someone puts it in front of you because the data is so obscured and abstracted away from us. Developers just don't think about it.
So
I didn't really think about it.
So here's a really minor example, and it's contrived, but I think it's kind of realistic. So let's say that we do image optimization on the images that are on our site, and we manage to shave just 10K of data off of a single image, which is a very modest gain in my experience. Like normally you can gain quite a bit more than that. But let's say we shave 10K off an unoptimized image. Okay, you might be like, well, that's wonderful. Like, why did you waste your time on doing that? That's nothing. You know, 10K is nothing. But then let's say there are 5 images on the page. Okay, now you've saved 50K. eh, you know, I mean, you're kind of getting up into something. But then let's say that that page receives 1,000 visitors a day, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now you're saving 50 megabytes a day of data, right?
Yeah.
And then
and
then over the course of a year, you're saving 16 gigabytes, right? And this is just network traffic, right? I mean, but it's also potentially in billable cell phone data plans. And then as you mentioned, you know, let's say we are serving like a super huge unoptimized image to a cell phone somewhere. Well, then all of that energy has to be used to transmit this massive thing throughout the cell towers. The phone gets it. And it's going to use more energy just to receive it. But then also the GPU in there is going to have to do extra work to scale it down to display there, which is going to drain the battery more, which, as you mentioned, then potentially millions or tens of millions or hundreds of millions of people then have to plug those phones in and they got to charge them more, all because of this one, you know, little thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. It's right there. It's obvious when you step through it in those clear and plain steps, it's really obvious that there is energy usage all the way along.
Yeah.
It wasn't until this year that someone really confronted me about it. He just basically asked at a conference, what's your opinion on the environmental impact of your work? And I was like, oh, don't have one. I've not really thought about it. Unfortunately, he didn't just drop it. He was like, yeah, but you must think about it. And I was like, is that an instruction? Or are you telling me to think about it now? But I did end up pondering it. I was like, yeah, it's an interesting concept. But the sad fact is my clients, and well, it's the global problem, right? Is everyone's got problems they feel are much closer to home. So the CFO, they're not bothered about saving the planet. They're bothered about more zeros in a bank account.
Sure.
So it's, I would struggle to sell my services based on the environmental impact purely because, yeah, CFO of a company isn't really, oh yeah, it'd be nice to, you know, use, you know, fewer CPU cycles, energy, blah, 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 blah. But really what we're going to do is just shift more of these kitchen knives, right? So it's a hard sell, but it's there. It's right there.
Yeah. And it's interesting to think about that impact, you know, and it, you know, if there do end up being, you know, more rolling blackouts in various countries or more countries on fire, then, you know, I don't know, maybe it will end up more important.
But at some point, my overly curmudgeonly view is going to be good again. I mean, like every restaurant site has me thinking, okay, yeah, React is pretty cool, but do we need style sheets? Because I just need an address and you're
right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Louis C.K. has a bit about people complaining about their flight. He's just irate that people are able to sit in a chair and fly. And they're complaining about, you know, some trivial thing. I don't know. I feel like the internet is so cool, but really, like, what do you want to say? Who are you saying it to? Like, I don't know.
Absolutely.
Maybe we get to focus on what the goal is. Sounds like the theme is a well-placed nerd that can connect the business goals with the like technical constraints and implementation is hugely helpful.
That's generally what helps out, because it's certainly my role. I've got to tell people what they want to hear, basically. I need to tell developers that it's a technical problem with a technical solution. I need to tell CEOs that, oh, it's just a simple cultural thing. And if you spend this money on speed curve, everything will be fine. And just try and make things around so they all line up. But it's a really interesting dynamic.
Well, I actually get immense satisfaction out of saving, you know, just a few percent. And people will be like, oh, big deal. You saved, you know, 3% or whatever. But again, multiplied over X number of images, multiplied by X number of people visiting it every day, you actually are making a big difference when you start to get up on the scale of things, you know?
Yeah, I mean, a small percent of a big number is still a big number, right? So
right.
I've got a friend, a really good friend of mine, Tom Hudson, security engineer here in the UK. And he's very wise beyond his years. And honestly, maybe 8 years ago, he got into a bit of a, not an argument, but a developer argument.
Oh, one of those. Was it how to pronounce GIF?
Yeah. Well, it wasn't as bad as that.
Okay.
But he optimized something, and someone was saying to him, oh, it's a waste of time, it's blah, 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 and, you know, and it was someone from a separate organization. It was like an on-Twitter thing, right, which is even more kind of embarrassing.
God, yeah.
But this was at a company, Sky, here in the UK, where we were working at scale, and this other guy, this external guy, was like, oh, yeah, but it's just a waste of time, you're saving 1%, what's it all for? So Tom did some back-of-the-napkin math. He was like, well, if we save 1%, that could be decommissioning up to 6 servers, right? And this was years ago before the site was even that big. He's like, yeah, that's not to be sniffed at. That's 6 racks we could have got rid of. And it's like, yeah, that thing of you shouldn't get blindsided by micro-optimizations, but, you know, small percent of a big number is still a big number.
Right. And I think that's the problem is when you're a developer, you're thinking about just this page. But in order to really understand the impact that you're having, you have to think about how many people are loading this page every day. And, right. and you really kind of have to do that multiplication to really comprehend the impact that you're going to be having.
I think one thing that I try and encourage a lot of my clients, like the business side of my clients, to do is give their developers more access to company financials. Mm. Obviously, it's a bit of a sensitive topic, but
sure.
you know, you'll get developers just not optimizing images, sticking them in an S3 bucket. And it's not until I go to the product owner and say, hey, can I get the login details for your actual Amazon account, right, where your credit card details are, because I want to see how much you're spending on bandwidth.
Yeah, because who knows? You might have a developer who saves you $35,000 a month on hosting, right?
Right, or you might have developers in that building who they don't care about optimizing images and they're losing you money.
Right,
it's a bit of a shady tactic. I've had to use it only once. With clients, a lot of them are reluctant to spend money on things like Cloudinary or ImageX or Fastly's IO or whatever it is. A lot of them are reluctant because it's more spend, it's more paperwork, it's more whatever.
Sure.
So can you not just show the marketing team how to optimize images? Can you not just show the designers how to optimize images? I was like, yeah, I can do, but I can guarantee a week after I've left, they'll stop doing it. And sure enough, they stopped doing it and you can't really enforce it. So I've only done this once. It was a company that just flat out refused to spend any money on Cloudinary, ImageX or whatever. So I just told their... it wasn't the CEO, I can't remember who it was, someone fairly high up. I was like, oh, by the way, your unoptimized images, your bandwidth was this much a month. We've optimized them. It's now 40% less. So basically, your staff not optimizing images is costing you money. Mm. And it became a rule. Like, if I find out you're not optimizing images, then you're losing us money, and that's not good. And it became not a disciplinary thing. That's way too drastic. But just by convincing someone higher up that you need to kind of rule with an iron fist, and it's not a very good cultural move, really, to scare people into doing it. But I was... backed into a bit of a corner. But yeah, put a cost against everything. Developers often don't realize the cost or value of their work, which is because the business obscures it from them.
Yeah. You're in the business where you do this kind of optimization. So you have people contacting you, and you mentioned earlier, you don't really feel that you have to prove it anymore. But Patrick, you do a whole lot of websites. Is it becoming more of a thing that performance written into the budget actually is something that clients are willing to go for?
Yeah, it's funny. Harry said something about maybe Google PageSpeed scores or Lighthouse scores. I've actually, and I don't know if I've said on the podcast before, it's definitely something that comes up and it's a selling point for mine. One thing that we do have to do though is, as was said earlier, when it comes to tracking scripts and all that, when we try to put that into the budget and try to give it some teeth, we have to say something like, you'll have a 90 plus score on Google PageSpeed, desktop and mobile before tracking scripts.
Yeah,
and it gives us a metric that we can hit and show that we gave them value and that we did our job. But it also then, you know, conversely can show them later on when it plummets down to a 50 or something, what it was.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, we've definitely seen it. Sometimes it comes up in the contract. Sometimes it's afterwards and, you know, the CEO discovers PageSpeed or whatever it is and says, why is our score not where we want it to be?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's very interesting. Like, and I'm doing more and more these days with front end JavaScript frameworks. I think if you're doing bundling and async and promises and all that good stuff, you can do that and be good for performance. I am a little bit concerned about the size of how many scripts are pulling in and what that means. Like, even if the score is happy, like, what is the real page weight and bloat that's coming along with it?
Mm.
So yeah, I it's something that we do and that we do make part of our contract. But yeah, I'm definitely a little bit concerned with how heavy the web is getting.
Yeah, and Addy Asmani has a great article on the cost of JavaScript where, you know, it's not equivalent. You know, 100K of JavaScript doesn't have the same impact as 100K of an image, right? Because it's got to be downloaded, parsed, executed, all that kind of fun stuff has to happen. Front-end frameworks or anything, really. It depends on how you're doing it, right? Because if you are moving some functionality to the front-end, well, that's less work that, in theory, the server has to be doing. So a lot of times the same work is done, but it's just changing where it's done. And you just have to ensure that it's being done efficiently wherever it happens to be being done.
Like, you're crowdsourcing your CPU cycles, right? You just say, you know what? We can save money on servers by get the users to do it for us.
Right. Yeah. And so Jamstack is really something that is kind of gathering steam these days. And I love me some Jamstack. I think it's fantastic for a lot of things, but there are things that it's terrible for. Right. So if you have a website that has tons of authors and they're constantly changing stuff, you're probably going to use more energy constantly rebuilding and redeploying the site. Right. So it depends on what you're building and you have to kind of pick the right tool for the job and make sure it is efficient in the right places for it to work, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of it just goes back to basics, like simple progressive enhancement. You know, I got into a bit of a thing, I don't know, a few months ago maybe. The Imgur website is a full React application. The main image on the Imgur website is the 117th request, right? The primary things you turn up to see isn't even requested until 117 requests in. And you just got to start thinking, like, who, at which point?
Yeah.
I think I made a really kind of throwaway comment, like, you know, product owner 6 weeks after the site goes live finds an index card stuck to a bottom of a bottle, like, shit, the image, we've got the image. It's
but again, we got the same thing we're talking about. We got the same thing we're talking about for newspapers, right? Because Imgur, they make money from ads. Mm-hmm. And so their site is horrible. It's one of the few. And I love Imgur because I love looking at memes and stupid pictures. Like I browse that stuff all the time and I freaking love it. It's like junk food for me. But if I browse that thing on the laptop, man, the fans kick on and it gets so hot that it burns my skin. Like it is bad. It is really bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, you know, just have an image tag and then lazy load all your ads, your comments, your upvotes, your whatever, your related images, lazy load that around it, but just solve the right problem first.
So
I got a lot of heat for that hot take.
So I'm channeling Jen's ghost, and she says that something that she wants to know about is if there were just three things that I should keep in mind to focus on to make my websites perform. And I know it's going to depend on the site and what's on there or whatever, but are there three simple things that just blindly blanket you would say, these are the three things where you're going to get the most bang for your buck? Like, what do you think they might be?
Well, this is such a good question. Right. Number one, use the platform. Mm. So don't be clever, right? Use HTML. HTML is fast, right? It's right there. It's the first response. Make use of that. So use the platform as much as possible. Don't do convoluted things to achieve what could have been done very simply. I think a part of the Imgur problem, and I think this is massive conjecture, and let's use any placeholder other than just blaming Imgur the whole time. If you're going to build a site that serves images, billions of images a day, there must be part of the engineering team that thinks, well, that sounds like a very, very complex problem. We must need a complex solution, right? Surely a simple image tag in HTML is not clever enough to solve that problem. So actually, no, it is, right? So don't overthink stuff. So use the platform. I would say that's the first thing I would say.
Number two is images. Or did I? Or no?
No. So I didn't get to that. So I was using Imgur as the example of
building
complex solutions to simpler problems. Second one, after use the platform, would be use as little as possible for as long as possible.
Hmm.
It's just generally in regards to things like third-party either libraries, you know, like your old NPM install, or it could be third-party providers such as analytics, right? How long can we get away without a tag manager? How long can we just like survive without it? And then only once you get to breaking point do you sort of say, okay, now we get a tag manager.
Mm.
So second one, yeah, as little as possible for as long as possible. And the third one, God, I don't know. General advice for always having a fast website would be don't trust anyone, right? If you are going to use third parties, really do vet them, because you can do all the good in the world. The moment you get a badly written third party or external library, whatever, just do your due diligence, I guess, and don't always assume that third party providers know what they're doing, because a lot of the time they don't.
Yeah, that's fantastic advice. And that's in thinking about, you know, what you're mentioning. Number one, use the platform. If it's there, utilize it because it's already built in. Don't, you know, layer crap on top of crap just to do what you want to do. Number two, use as little as possible for as long as possible, right? If you don't really need that tag manager or whatever, don't use it yet. And then number three, don't trust anyone. Vet your third-party tools and scripts. I think that's great advice. That's great advice. You know, I probably would have said something like, well, you know, optimize your images because those are the most important thing. But I think your advice is way better because it's more higher level thinking and you can apply it to anything, not just images, you know?
Yeah, because that's the thing. Like, I think all those three, I'm actually writing those down because there's a blog post in this. But yeah, I think those three things are transferable across traditional read-only websites or highly interactive apps. They're transferable across text heavy versus image heavy content.
Yeah.
So those are the things I would philosophically look out for. A lot of my ethos comes from Jeremy Keith, right? Mm. He's very, very wise. He's been around since the good old days. And sure, a lot of my thinking just is echoed by him, or mine echoes his, I guess. Just keep it simple. Like use the platform, know what the sort of appropriate things to do are, and yeah.
Or as we say in New York, KISS, right? Keep it simple, stupid.
Stupid. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, Harry, this has been fantastic. And Jennifer and myself and everyone here, we want to have you on again. because
that's been really good.
I think we could go on for forever about this and any number of things, but I think that about wraps it up for another episode of the devmode.fm podcast. If you'd like to have every episode delivered to your favorite player, you can subscribe via RSS or find us on iTunes or Google Play. And if you like what we're doing, please review the show on iTunes. It's the best way to help others find the show. You can also follow us on Twitter at devmode.fm, and we'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode. Leave us a comment on the devmode.fm website where we can continue the conversation. For the devmode.fm podcast, I'm Andrew Welch.
I'm Matt Stein.
I'm Patrick Harrington.
I'm Jennifer Blumberg. And thank you, Harry Roberts, for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
I feel terrible that Jen unfortunately dropped off from the episode, and I feel bad for myself about the editing that I'm about to have to do too.
So angry. Yeah, that's gonna be a tricky one. Poor Jen, that sucks.
Yeah, but that's another reason why you got to come on again, man. We